So I dropped out from the PhD program in the end to get into business. In the meantime, I had a chance to write a book and do a lot of publications and policy papers as well. So that was a lot of fun. I guess it depends how you see entrepreneurship. To me, it's solving problems. And I think, yes, there were a lot of signs that I solve things differently. Things that people take for granted, for me, was a bit harder to accept and take it for granted. And you start questioning it, you start changing it and fixing it.
How do you start from nothing up against a $6 billion company and create momentum from scratch?
It really comes down to that you are building something that people want. That gives you the momentum. So most people right now, what they do is they take a closed model, they take rug, and they put the knowledge there, off we go, right? That just doesn't work if you're in a regulated space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Successes in the Mind with me, Oliver Bruce, and Hugo Tilmuth. From the trading floors of Goldman Sachs to decoding human behavior at scale, today's guest is a true data visionary. Tushka Bulat is the founder of StreetBees and now Eloquent AI, a groundbreaking platform built for regulated industries where autonomous AI agents handle high-stake conversions with unmatched accuracy and precision. It's ushering in a new era of intelligence, always on customer engagement, powered by self-improving technology. With a background in economics and international development, Tushka has been recognized by Forbes and named as one of the UK's top 100 entrepreneurs. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show.
So we are here today with Tucci, and we are so excited to have you on the podcast today. You've had an amazing run-up over the last, 10 years or so, and I think the audience is really going to enjoy hearing your story. You know, the exit, the what's next, searching through to figure out the next space that you're going to conquer. But let's go all the way back to the beginning. Can you tell us, were you always going to be an entrepreneur, or was it, something that came out of the dark? Can you tell us where you started your journey?
That's really funny you ask, because I'm a complete accidental entrepreneur. I never thought I would be. Funny story, there are videos of me when I was 5 years old. People ask me, what do you want to become when you grow up? And I used to say, I'm going to become the president of the United States. Bear in mind, I'm growing up in Turkey, right? So people then reminded me that, well, you need to be born in the United States for that to happen. So I had to change course.
Amazing. Well, you've moved to the US now, so maybe that's the start of the...
Who knows?
Elon's managed to do it, basically. So
Elon's
he might be next.
He's a sore subject at the moment.
He's opening up the route for me.
No, so tell us, so you're growing up in Turkey, and, what was the... Were there any kind of early signs, or did it come at a later stage that you were going to go down the entrepreneurial path?
I guess it depends how you see entrepreneurship. To me, it's solving problems. Yeah. And I think, yes, there were a lot of signs that I solve things differently, things that people take for granted. For me, it was a bit harder to accept and take it for granted. And you start questioning it, you start changing it and fixing it. But my focus for many, many years was politics. And I ended up studying also political science at university and spent many years working with World Bank, working on political problems like poverty. So I always thought that's my focus. And yes, there's a lot of space for entrepreneurial activity. For example, I wrote my master's thesis about microfinance, and that was a very noble approach to solve the problem of poverty. But what really happened there is, after doing, I got accepted to my PhD position at Cambridge. It was a fully funded position, so it would have been very difficult to say no. So I took it, but during those years, I lived in India for a year, I realized more and more, if you want to solve problems, business is actually a really great way of doing that. And you may have greater impact through a business than becoming a politician.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. And so tell us about how that kind of PhD transitioned into, was it StreetBees straight out the gate, or did you do something before that?
No. So I dropped out from the PhD program in the end to get into business. In the meantime, I had a chance to write a book and do a lot of publications and policy papers as well. So that was a lot of fun. But I started getting frustrated that you see the solution, it's not getting implemented. Mm-hmm. You are writing policy papers, but people who need to actually then, take it into action are not doing that. So all of a sudden, the world of business started looking very attractive because you can stay in control of what's happening, right? So I dropped out, and it was 2008.
Yeah, well, blimey, bad time.
Really bad timing. I did not think that through.
No, I don't think anyone did in 2008.
Not really. And admittedly, it was a really hard year for me. So I moved from Cambridge to London. I was very determined that's what I wanted to do. So there weren't any, you know, question marks in my mind. But it was practically impossible to get a job at the time. And funny story, actually, I got accepted to start in a, you know, top-tier consultancy company. Mm-hmm. But they give offers 9 months out. And I need to stay in London, right? So I needed to find another way of being able to stay in the country. And I ended up actually importing vodka.
Really?
No way.
So random. So basically, I decided that I don't want to go back to Istanbul until I'm waiting for my job to start. And I met someone in the airport who was trying to bring some like real high quality luxury vodka to the London market. Mm-hmm. I said to him, you know what? You feel like you can't do it, you're moving back, leave the cases with me, let me give it a go, right? So I rebranded the whole thing, put a new label on it, and then started selling into clubs,
right?
Like in big cases.
Oh
I
God.
Made more money doing that for like 9 months than my, you know, annual salary as a consultant, basically. Maybe I should have never quit.
What was the name of the vodka brand?
It's called Istanbul.
Istanbul?
Yeah, it's a beautiful name, right?
Is it still in existence?
I don't think so. Right. I think they sold it.
Yeah. So you were helping out. You weren't actually physically involved in the sort of...
No. I was just selling, basically, just selling.
And that was where you got the flavor for starting, or at least being involved in something?
I guess so. Again, then we wouldn't call it entrepreneurship, you know? Like, it was just making money, basically, at that stage. But again, it's very similar to, you know, getting involved in microfinance, etc. You see a problem, you need to solve it, and you find a way.
So when you kind of got involved in business, but then you sort of started to come up with ideas to build businesses yourself, how did that sort of thought process go?
So I was super lucky to work in a consultancy because it was the kind of time we were going through transition into digital companies, right? So I had the pleasure of working with the founding team of Just Eat, and we learned so much. Then we started working on an M&A deal with a company called Yemek Sepeti, based in Turkey, which is like a predecessor of Deliveroo. Okay. And working these founders and CEOs really gave me a lot of energy and made me realize it's technology that I want to work on. And towards the end of it, I was starting to think about actually automating consultancy. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting thing, right? You start as an analyst, your working hours are pretty much like 8 to midnight every day.
Yeah.
I'm not even joking. Like, that's how you work as a consultant. Maybe it's changed now a little bit. But a lot of the things we were doing were very automatable, so to speak. So we started writing a bit code on the side, just like, so I can go home early, basically, right? Let's just automate a couple of the functions here. And that kind of showed me that, all right, I mean, more and more, I can add more and more. Either I can stay here and then get my work done by 4 p.m. and go home, or I leave and I turn all of this into a business. Mm-hmm. And that's how StreetBeast started.
So it was very much to solve a problem, and the problem was that you didn't want to do as much work.
I'm very lazy.
It's like, the classic thing. You want to hire the laziest guy.
And then he's going to find.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so how did that actually come into fruition? Were you thinking like you would solve the kind of the finding of data problem? Or like how did that actually come into fruition?
It actually came from the customer side, to be perfectly honest, because what was happening is we were exclusively working on M&A deals, and we need global data for those. What happens is we ended up organizing our own field work in Brazil just to size how big the takeaway food market is in Brazil. Because if you commission something to someone like Nielsen or Ipsos or Kantar, there's like 3 to 4 month turnaround time. M&A doesn't wait for that, right? Like, we have deal deadlines. So I would be literally contacting people in Brazil personally, getting people on the ground, going into takeaway restaurants, trying to size the market, basically. So that's kind of where the need came from. We said, what if we had people on the ground in every country in the world through their own mobile phone, which everyone has in their pocket, actually in real time, you know, processing data for us.
Yeah.
It just seemed so possible. It was crazy why no one was doing it. So that was the moment I said, okay, this got to be done. Someone got to do this.
And did you do that from inside the business that you were at in terms of, did you come up with the business idea and then leave the company?
That's totally what happened. So I spoke to my boss, who was like amazing person who supported me through the journey in consulting company for a long time. And initially his reaction was, are you crazy?
Yeah.
You know, we earn really well here. Yeah, like, why do you want to leave? Right. But when I explained the idea, he also felt like it's a no-brainer. He became my very first investor at StreetBees. And, you know, he made 100 times returns on his initial capital.
Amazing.
So everyone is happy in the end.
Now, teacher, just tell me, when you're starting a company and you're working for a business, is it a good time to start a company? Is it better to leave the business before you start a company? Obviously, you were still employed when you were coming up with the idea, right? Using someone else's time or money, if you will. A lot of entrepreneurs want to know when the best time to take that leap is. When is that time?
I think rather than what is the right time, the more important question is just be open and transparent. I think if you hide things, you're going to have an integrity problem and that's going to eat you up. Instead, just talk to people and ask them, when do you think I should leave, right? If they're feeling uncomfortable, I mean, I'm sitting in front of my computer, ideas are coming up, like no one is going to blame you for that. You're doing it on my clock, right? But if you actually like literally running a business on the side and you didn't tell anyone, that's just not nice.
No.
We had such a great relationship. By the time I left, that company also became my first customers.
Right.
They became my first investors, etc. So I would always think that like the timing depends how ready you are.
Yeah.
If you have a family you are taking care of, maybe you can't make the leap quite easily, right? But if you're open and keep the conversation going, then it shouldn't be too difficult.
And in terms of being open then, when you have an idea that you want to run with, for instance, how open should you be with that idea? Should you go to people and say, look, this is the idea I've got. What do you think of this idea? Because a lot of entrepreneurs try and keep things a secret because they don't want someone to steal the idea, right? Which is, you know, you can read between the lines. I don't think it's the best idea to keep it a secret. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think I agree with you.
Yeah.
As a first-time entrepreneur, you may be too worried and you may be too precious. But any of us here who build something, we know that it's all about execution, right? Like 99.9% execution. Probably at any given point, 1,000 other people right now have your idea.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's very rare.
And probably 100 are working on it.
100%.
Yes.
So I would say be even more open than you think is okay. And it will be okay because it all will come down to how fast you can hire, how fast you can raise capital, etc. It really won't matter. But what I also found is that you're going to run into a lot of people who really want to help you.
Yeah.
And I found that absolutely amazing. People get out of their way to help you. So you sit down in a coffee shop, you're explaining what you're doing to a good friend. All of a sudden, he's going to come up with ideas that, oh, actually, I met this person in this place. Like, you know, our friend second ago just told me that I mentioned your company to someone who is trying to solve an LLM problem in finance. I should introduce you. He can only do that because at a dinner, I explained to him over 45 minutes what I'm doing, what I'm building. So I would say just absolutely share with anyone who is willing to listen to you.
And how important is speed in that process? So obviously there's an element of people look at it and go, okay, you have to be intelligent to run a company. But actually, is it more speed orientated? Is it first to market? Is it just doing things quickly, making mistakes and learning rather than the intelligence piece?
It's not about first to market, but it's definitely about momentum.
Yeah.
Everything, I think, in an early stage startup is about momentum, right? Because you've got nothing else. How much technology do you have? Not much. How many customers do you have? How much capital do you have? In StreetBees, we were competing with businesses which has $5 billion, $6 billion in revenues, right? So what you got? Well, you got momentum.
Yeah.
Right? That's in your advantage.
You're agile.
You can respond very quickly. Like Unilever was one of my biggest customers, which is also a very funny story how we got them. When they emailed us, we got back to them in 45 minutes.
This is half a battle. I always say to our sales guys, it's like when a lead lands, you contact them straight away.
You close
you
straight away.
You have to get back to them quickly.
100%.
24 hours is too long.
No, you can't wait for that. And of course, that doesn't mean don't sleep. Like, you know, of course, do what you need to do. But to me, there's no such thing as working hours, right? If I'm watching a movie and something comes through, I am going to respond to that email. Yeah. I'm not going to wait until the movie finishes. And that's an advantage, right? Like, yeah. I can do that. I can actually get back. Whereas, let's say my competitor is a $6 billion revenue business. They hire people who work 9 to 5. It's not, they have nothing on the line, mm-hmm. personally, mm-hmm. to be that agile, which also brings me back. The first 10, 20 people you hire is incredibly important, mm-hmm. because they need to be thinking with the same mindset that you're thinking.
Yeah, speed.
So going back to creating momentum, you know, you've spoken about how important it is, but how do you start from nothing up against a $6 billion company and create momentum from scratch?
It really comes down to that you are building something that people want. That gives you the momentum. That's why I think coming from within the industry really matters, mm. right? Because you already see a problem. People are in pain with yeah. the current providers, and you have the contacts. And then you go to those people and say that, listen, we were having this problem. Remember, I have a company which is solving that, exactly that problem. Do you want to give it a go? And make the barriers as low as possible to say yes.
Yeah.
That's what we always taught to our sales team, that make it so easy to say yes. That doesn't mean free pilots. I'm passionately against any free work. Mm-hmm. And there are really good reasons for that. People won't take it seriously, right? If they are not actually having to pay for it. But other than that, make it super, super easy to say yes. That's how you get the momentum. And then you go all in. It doesn't matter how big the contract is. You go all in to develop.
The land and expand model.
For us, that was definitely the case. I think any enterprise business, that was super important. I still remember our net revenue retention was 158%. Wow. And that's the most important number that we always kept our eye on.
Yeah. We'll just take a quick pause there. We'll get back to the episode in a minute. But I just wanted to say thank you to you guys who are listening to this episode, who are subscribing and following the podcast. If you haven't already, please do hit that follow and subscribe button. And maybe you can also share it with friends, with family, and with colleagues to hopefully inspire them on their entrepreneurial journey. Genuinely, we can't do this podcast without you. So thank you. Let's get back to the episode. That's amazing. And in terms of how you kind of instilled that into your team, because obviously starting a company first, 10 to 20 people, as you say, is super, super crucial. How do you instill that speed piece, that agility piece, that want for them to be as engaged or indeed as driven as you are when you're fundamentally the owner of the company? How do you do that?
Okay. Admittedly, I didn't always get it right, you know, and we made some pretty big mistakes in that regard. And then you learn very fast. And I think two key takeaways I would share is, first of all, the answer is no, they won't be exactly how agile. Like, you're literally, you know, on holiday when you sleep, it's literally in your head. You're obsessed with it. And it's not fair to expect from anyone else who is not you to be that obsessed, right? You need to accept that. The second one is, having said that, they should at least be 80% there,
yes.
right? And if they are not, they are probably not right hire. Mm-hmm. But I remember, like, we raised Series A and we needed to deploy that capital really fast. We had hugely ambitious growth targets and we had to hire super fast. We went from 12 people to 60 people in 8 months.
Yes.
What I now know is that that's not a great idea. And if you're going to do that, you really need to prioritize some top-notch recruiters, not external, in-house recruiters, to do that for you.
Interesting. So you'd hire a recruiter to scale first, yeah. rather than bung the, whatever it is, 15 or 20% over to a recruiter.
100%. The reason is, at that point, you are looking for culture fit.
Yes.
More so than anyone else. We made so many recruitment mistakes. We brought in people from key competitors who were literally had the book of customers. And we thought, what a great hire. Yeah.
What can go wrong?
We're done. Like, it's all good. I can go home. They couldn't make a single sale 6 months in. And you're asking, like, you were literally the, you know, godfather to the child of the person we are trying to sell to. Mm-hmm. How on earth we can't get a meeting? Yeah. How is this even possible? I'm getting meetings by sitting in the canteens of these businesses, right? Like, literally trying to get people to actually talk to me. It's the spirit. comfort being uncomfortable. Some of us don't like using our relationships, right? Like, I see it. This is not actually taking advantage of a relationship. You have a problem. I happen to know you. I have a solution. This is a win-win. Yep. Mm-hmm. So when I come to you and knock on your door, I'm not worried that I'm actually damaging the relationship. I feel like, first of all, you can still say no.
Yeah.
It won't influence our relationship. Although I'll insist, you could still say no. More important, I'm bringing you something that's good for you too. So, you know, let's chat, let's discuss. You can't hire people who don't think that way. I mean, we had such funny stories. I remember someone we hired for sales. And in the first week, we asked him, okay, this is our process. So you go through your LinkedIn, you do this, you do that. I was like, oh yeah, I don't feel comfortable using my LinkedIn for business purposes. It's a personal network. I was like, are you serious? Are you for real? You're a salesperson.
Yes.
Literally, we hired you because of your LinkedIn, right? And you're telling me that you're not comfortable using it. You're clearly in the wrong company.
That's like buying a car and going, I'm not going to use the car for driving because I just like to look at it. That's literally the same principle.
Literally, yeah. So we learned it the hard way that we went through a period where we hired and fired fast. That's not good. It's not good for the company. It's not good for your growth. Mm. So I do it very differently now. I'm going to take the company to 12 people first. I'm personally choosing every single person, being very open on expectations. And now I know some amazing recruiters who would come in-house and work with me, say, for a 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then if I'm going from 12 to 60, you know, I would bring in someone who knows the culture we set for the company, who knows what we are looking for, and then roll out with them.
Interesting. So mitigating that risk, essentially.
Absolutely, because an external hire is right to use at the right size of the company. Once you're over 100 people, that makes sense. But up until then, you need really strong control over who's coming in.
Mm-hmm. And when you raise your Series A then, just what did that look like? Because you've obviously started a company. You've never run a company before. You raised some money. You've probably never raised money before. How did you kind of navigate that then?
I mean, look, I feel I was incredibly lucky to have some amazing people who helped me through the journey. What happened is, and again, let's come back to, you know, your networks. I started the company, I realized I don't know any engineers, software engineers, like closely enough, and I don't know any VC. So where do I start? That's pretty much the two things I need. I need engineers and I need capital, right? So it's going to be tough. Yeah. So I said, okay, who do I know? Well, I used to be in M&A in private equity, not quite VC, but they've got to know some people in VC. So I started knocking on the door of every single person in the last 6 years who worked with me in any M&A deal. Many of them even did not remember me. I was an analyst in the corner, right? But you remind them who you were, and then they eventually remember. And you call again, and you call again. And one of those guys, actually, from Morgan Stanley, agreed to introduce me to the chief strategy officer of Unilever. Okay. And then he introduced me to Unilever Ventures. And then they introduced me to another fund. All of a sudden, I got Unilever on the line to become a customer. And then I got amazing Local Globe on the phone. And all of a sudden, we were in a meeting with Robin Klein, who is an incredible entrepreneur himself, an incredible investor, who agreed to join our board at the seed level. And from then on, you know, the company's acceleration and growth trajectory completely got transformed. Because when we said, okay, let's do Series A, now I had a mentor who can actually walk me through. These are the best funds. This is how we raise. And this is like, you know, what do we do? When do we do? Etc. Yeah. You learn very fast.
So it's ask for help and get money. Ask for money, get help.
100%. Like, that's the constant cycle, isn't it? Like, ask for help and then you get some money. And absolutely. And I think you're just going to be comfortable as an entrepreneur. I always remind myself that people want to help.
Yes.
Everyone wants to be part of a great story.
Yes.
And if you are writing a great story, you should not be feeling shy about asking for help. People want to help.
So you managed to get, you know, one of the best investors on board. You then went on to raise how much after your Series A? So you've raised 80 million now in total?
In total, yes. But some of that was debt. Yeah. So we did also venture debt. I think the total VC capital was around 55 million.
Wow. It's a good number.
It's a good number. I mean, we did some, one could argue it was too much. Another store for another day.
What was the valuation at that 55 million?
I can't share valuations.
You can't share that higher.
Well, obviously. But coming back to the story of the like how we raised, so Series A was around 12 million.
Okay.
Then we took some venture debt and then we did Series B. And, you know, at every step, obviously, you are raising the capital you think you need, but also you are ready to deploy.
Yes.
I think the really interesting thing is, you know, for people to watch the journey from the outside, it looks like you just jumped to raising tens of millions, you know, then almost 100 million in total.
Yeah.
It looks impossible. It looks impossible, you know, for someone who hasn't done it before.
And depressing. It feels depressing sometimes watching from the outside, right? Yeah.
But do you have any tips other than obviously just asking your network? You know, is there anything that people can do to prepare for a fundraise, to make their company look better? You know, really to just kind of get ahead in that process?
First thing to say is maybe delete LinkedIn and X from your phone while you are raising, because I find it incredibly discouraging and depressing, because when you're on the outside, it always feels like an overnight success. And then you wonder, why is it not happening to me? Why everyone else is so successful? Why everyone else is so lucky? What's wrong with me? Mm-hmm. The thing is, we all feel that way.
Yeah.
I literally stopped looking at LinkedIn because it felt like I'm the biggest loser in the world and everyone else is doing so well, right? Which is so not true, because we don't write posts when you make you send 20 emails and no one got back to you. No one writes a post about that.
Yes.
But maybe these days...
They're starting to. Almost ironically.
And we all should. What I said to my new co-founder in the new company is his first business... that like all these amazing news you are seeing, there is 2 to 3 years of work that was quietly, heads down, done that you don't know anything about. Yeah. So don't get disheartened when you see these great successes. We should feel very happy for them, knowing that how much hard work must have gone into that. Just to, you know, for anyone listening and feeling maybe a bit low, we had moments in seed raise where people talk to me that consultants don't make good entrepreneurs. You're not technical. You're never going to make it. This business is too ambitious. In Europe, it's impossible to build it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you name it. We've heard it, right? The thing is, the way I think about it is, this is not even a rejection, okay? So there are two things that might be happening. You're talking to the wrong person. Wrong fund, wrong engineer, wrong person, right? So it's part of your process to keep moving, right? Or maybe it was the right person. It was someone you really wanted to be involved. It's just not the right timing. Yeah, yeah. Keep talking, right? And eventually someone is going to look into your eyes and say, this is a huge opportunity. I think you've got a shot and I want to do it with you. And then off you go. Like, I always tell anyone I'm mentoring is that you should walk out of an investment meeting feeling energized about how big this can get, how great is the opportunity, what can you do next. If you're walking out of the meeting feeling defeated, you know, all of your energy sucked out of you, even if it's a top name, it's probably not right for you, because your investor shouldn't leave you feeling that way.
Absolutely. And it, you know, the firms that are, you know, now globally known, they can have a number of different partners, you know, and it could be just the partner isn't the right fit for you and your style and, you know, your way of exchanging energy or what have you. But no, I think it's fascinating how you've managed to do that. But also going back to the beginning, I love hearing how people kind of hacked their way to actually making the thing work. You had an incredibly difficult challenge in that you were building, you know, both supply and demand side at the same time with the marketplace. Your, you know, supply was thousands of people, presumably, you know, normal people on the street going out and doing the requests for you. And then also you had to build these multinational corporations to trust you in order to get those people to work with you. Like, how on earth do you do that from a standing start?
It's a great question. So there's a lot of hacking that goes on early stage, right? And I think people think with big enterprises that wouldn't work. The reality is there's no such thing as a big enterprise. There's a person there, a human who is having a conversation with you. And as long as we are still working with, this may actually change a lot with agents, but as long as we have a human on the other side, you have a chance, basically, to get them excited. One of the most interesting stories we've got is we started working with Unilever because finally we got an intro, right, through a private equity, etc. And I remember really well because he was in India, I was in a ski trip in Switzerland, and the line was terrible, right? Keep cutting off. We talked for a while. He said to me, "Tucci, if I understand correctly what you are saying, this will be so revolutionary that I'm happy to try, even if there's 5% chance it's going to work," right?
5%,
right?
Wow.
And we were very early stage, first customer. First customer became Unilever, right? It's pretty crazy. But the solution we were bringing in, and for those of you who are not familiar with StreetBees, what we were doing is basically, rather than relying on market research, we would take real-life moments from people in the form of what you say in a video, photos you take, text writing. We invented the concept of conversational research 10 years ago. This is a pre-LLM world. And we were taking all of this data and then using unsupervised learning and NLP to be able to then analyze all of that data for real-time consumer intelligence. It was unheard of. People would tell us that video is not data. What are you talking about, right? And we were doing this in millions, right? So it wasn't like one or two videos. We were taking like hundreds of thousands, millions of data points coming in. So he said to me that this is so much going to transform the sector. I'm happy to try. So we signed the contract. I remember very well. It was £27,000. You know, very small for Unilever. Huge win for us. Yeah. But because he took a chance on me, I knew if, even if it takes me to fly to Indonesia to get this delivered, yeah, I'm going to do it, yeah, right? Because someone took a chance on you. You can't fail it now. And it was Indonesia. The data request was, we had one single user in Indonesia at the time. So how do we do it now, right? We got the customer to do it. How are we going to find the users? We did not fly to Indonesia. But we did something actually quite similar. We said, okay, you know what? Flights are too expensive. So instead, why don't we just go talk to people who are about to fly to Indonesia, which is a lot cheaper. So we sent interns to Heathrow to literally camp by the, you know, British Airlines, Indonesian Airlines, and ask every single person onboarding, right? When you land, you're going to do a laundry, right? Like you're going to wash your clothes. Would you like to get paid just to take a video of that?
Oh my God.
And then we started giving people leaflets, how to do it. And we were like, you're going to get paid $10. It takes a 3-minute video. We just want to see how you do your laundry. And especially like everyone is looking at you. Are you absolutely insane? Like what kind of a pervert you are? You want to watch like a video of me doing laundry, right? We're like, with your clothes on, you know, come on. It worked. Not only that, we got dozens of people through the airlines, but then we gave referral fees to everyone, right? So you're like, you land there, and then my co-founder is a wizard of user acquisition. He contacted universities in Indonesia. We got university students on the streets, like signing people up as users. You might be asking, why didn't you just use Meta? Back in the time, like in those countries, it just wasn't as strong to get users. And also you would get a lot of generalist users who would then not be willing to do a video like that, right? Yeah. It wasn't getting us like great returns. So that's how we got started. And we delivered like thousands of people doing tens of thousands of videos. Yeah. And they loved the results so much. In about 3 years, we turned Unilever from a 27K customer to a 2 million a year customer. Wow. And to me, this is really exciting because we were also told by some other people, you know, one of our biggest competitors, their CEO heard from Unilever about us, paid a visit to our office. And I remember very well, like he said, we could internalize this solution. And at that point, we said, well, we are not up for sale. Like, we just started, literally. And he said, but you're never going to make it. Like, the customers you are serving are very, very conservative. They won't shift. it was just so much fun when we stole like a 4 million Coca-Cola contract, you know, from them, obviously. You know, it's hard to hold yourself yeah. back from sending that cheeky email. Would you like to pay another visit?
Coffee's on me this time.
Yeah.
In terms then, I guess, of what that looked like when you went through to the exit, right? So you obviously scaled it, you've taken it to the level you've taken it to. How did you then package it up to get it to a point where you could shift the business?
So that wasn't quite our journey, right? I never thought about selling the business, right? But it came to a place during COVID, we grew 50% month on month. The business exploded. Why? All of a sudden, everyone needs real-time data.
Yep.
They turn to usual suspects like Nielsen, and Nielsen says, well, I can turn it around. I can go down from 4 weeks to 2 weeks. What 2 weeks? The world is changing every day. Like, you know, and all of a sudden we were on their radar. Even people who told us that they would never shift started getting in our wait list. So we had to capitalize on that. And afterwards, we were getting to a place, the company was getting big enough and starting to stabilize. And at that point, me and my co-founder started thinking about the business still has a lot to do, but not necessarily with us.
Right.
And I'll be very open with you why, right? We are very ambitious people. I wanted to build a multi-billion dollar business.
Yeah.
And at some point, speaking to the competitors, start partnering with them, you really understand your real market size.
Yeah.
Right. And we thought that addressable market was around 12, 13 billion. And we believed that we can build a billion-dollar revenue business taking about 10% of that market. It turned out real addressable market was more around 1.4 billion, say 2 billion max. Just there wasn't enough upside for us left, especially the company already reached great valuation. So we said, you know what? The company needs to keep going. Not necessarily with us.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a different thing. Like, we didn't actually prepare the business so, per se for a sale.
Okay, so you basically de-risked, moved away, I guess, in time. And you're still involved in it in any way, shape or form?
I am, yes, of course. I have less time, so I sold a lot of my shares. And I still have some shares. I still have a board position, but I'm not taking the role because I'm so busy with the new business. It just wouldn't be fair. Also, someone gave me a great advice when I was thinking through, you know, shall I stay in the board? Shall I become a chair? Like, you know, what should be my new role? Someone very smart, who is an exited founder himself, said to me that you will find it incredibly frustrating if you stay involved and they no longer listen to you. Because they're going to take a different direction. You're going to be like, what are you doing? And it's not fair to the new CEO. It's not fair to you. So, and I think, you know, at the time it was quite hard. It's your baby. You want to stay involved. But I think it was the right decision to actually really step out.
Me again. I promise we'll get back to the episode in a minute. I just wanted to say thanks so much for listening. Hit that subscribe, hit that follow button. It means a lot. We cannot do this podcast without you guys. Back to the episode. So what did you do after you'd stepped out? Because you've got to have some level of motivation. You're, as you say, quite an ambitious person, right? And you want to get that multi-billion dollar business off the ground. So you kind of move away from Street Bees. You're still sort of involved in it to a certain extent. What next?
Well, I picked up kitesurfing.
Okay, amazing. Wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, I wasn't either. I'm not really good at it. But the thing is, that's my life philosophy. There's no such thing as being good at something. You just learn.
Yeah.
Right?
You just get better.
You just get better. And so, yeah, this jokes aside, that's literally what I did. I went to Sicily to a kitesurfing camp.
Lovely.
Stayed there.
Lovely.
And, you know, ending up with bruises every day all over.
How long were you there for?
I was there for like 2 months.
Oh, wow. So you really took some time out properly.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I did kitesurfing. And then when I got like too tired of that, I stayed in a vineyard, which was much easier.
Why did you bother starting another company? That sounds like a perfect life.
Well, what's interesting
is I asked myself that question.
The first time we met, you told me you were not going to start another company.
And yes.
You've broken your own rule.
I know. What happened?
You must be really shit at kitesurfing.
That's so true. That must be it. I was like, this is hopeless. Let's do something I'm actually good at.
So you started a company. And what is the company? What does it do? How did it scale?
Absolutely. Okay, so I started Eloquent AI. Eloquent AI is an agentic operating system for financial services. Okay. It's a lot of big words. Basically, whenever a financial institution has a customer-facing agent, we run that agent and we make sure it's compliant, it's always factual, and it's auditable. Everything it says is auditable. How did we come into that? I mean, the thing is, this is where the passion comes from, right? I understand the AI technology quite intrinsically. We built a business 10 years ago using, you know, knowledge graphs, etc. Before I left StreetBees, I launched the first GPT-based product in the UK market. We became the first commercial partner in the UK for OpenAI.
I didn't know that.
And it was an amazing product. It was very early stage GPT-2, but we already automated the agents for consumer research. And I was like blown away what's possible. Then I call my bank to shift some, you know, money from somewhere to somewhere. I'm on the line waiting to talk to someone. And let's be honest, most of the customer support people don't love their jobs, right? I don't want to be unfair. There are some who are excellent, but on average, maybe they had a bad day and they are taking it out on you. The thing is with agents, they don't get a bad day. No. They are always enthusiastic.
No days off.
No days off. They're always empathetic. They always like to listen to you. They can always be funny if you want them to be funny, etc., right? So it was a quite stark difference in my eyes that I know what is possible with this technology. And yet in my real life, the adoption of agentic structures in, you know, your trading platform, your insurance provider, your pensions provider, nada.
Nada, yeah.
Why is this happening?
Well, I think people are scared. They know how difficult it can get if they get it wrong, so they don't want to touch it. And I guess that's where you guys come in then.
100%. And I totally understand that fear. The thing is, we've got to make things transparent and visible to address the fear. Rather than going in and saying, well, you just have to trust the AI, you know, it knows what it's doing, well, why should I? Instead, what we do is let's make every single component of AI perfectly possible to monitor, see exactly what's going on, but also have an entire audit trail. Right? How it made every single decision, how it generated every single utterance, we should be able to control and check.
In terms of agents, I think it's worth just double-clicking into what an agent is for people that don't understand specifically.
100%. So, and I think part of the problem is anything can be an agent, right? So from, for example, automating functionalities in any workflow. Let's say you're an insurance company, processing claims, deciding quotes, assessing risk to be able to assign a quote. They can all be done by agents, right? These are what we call internal functions. There's still liability. You still have to show to authorities that you made the risk assessment in the correct way. And I mean, of course, they should be regulated for good reason. What we are doing is, though, even more high stakes. Yeah. Because if there is a mistake made, it goes straight to the customer.
Yeah.
We are customer facing, right? So we have to build something that's absolutely error proof.
Super tight. Super.
It's super tight. It's super controlled. Yeah. It never makes a mistake. And we can totally observe. I mean, I'm sure some of you are familiar with the UK consumer duty regulation. Mm-hmm. A bank in the UK has to show every single decision, every single thing we said to a consumer was in the best interest of the consumer. This is already difficult to comply with human agents. Yes. Now you need to comply with that with your AI agents, right? Yeah. So how do you do that? That's exactly the problem we are solving.
So in terms of the agent side of things, do you think blockchain is going to have a huge play in that world in terms of being able to audit that trail?
Oh, it's a really good question. I'm not an expert on blockchain. Does it need to be decentralized? I think if you're talking about money movement, I think that's a great idea, right? Auditing the entire trail with that makes sense. But if you're actually more on the side of checking, is this generated answer correct, you probably still want a centralized system. And I mean, some of our customers even still require on-premise. It's kind of funny. We are going back from cloud to on-premise, you know, deployment for AI right now.
Because in terms of the agents, then what you don't build out the foundational model, right? You've built that on top of something. You dev on top of a foundational model that's out there already.
So we do use foundational models, but we have our own large language model called Oratio.
I love it.
Why Oratio? Because obviously eloquent AI is all about speech, right? We are talking and conversing with customers. What Oratio does is domain-specific model training, so that we can control the full conversation. If you are using a closed model like OpenAI, it's great that you're like GPT, it's great that it's a frontier model, their reasoning is amazing, that's all fantastic, but it's a closed model. I can't play with the parameters. How much control I can have is limited to fine-tuning. I can't go any deeper than that. The moment you build your own domain-specific model, I can actually now fully control what is embedded. I can give a specific example if it's helpful. Just something super basic, right? If you got a mortgage, your bank probably told you that you have to get a life insurance. They can even require that, or they can recommend that. A bank is allowed to do that. But if you go to an insurance company and say that I just got a mortgage, should I get a life insurance? If you use a closed model or just like LangChain with a rug or something, it's going to say, yes, you should. You just violated the regulation by doing that, because as an insurance company, there's unauthorized recommendation. You are not allowed to do it. But if the underlying model learned from the internet, there's just so much talk about life insurance, mortgage. You should get a life insurance if you have a mortgage. It learned that. With Oratio, we can unlearn that from the underlying model and use basically reward modeling for reinforcement learning. I don't want to go into too much technical, but if you are familiar with DeepSeek, it's the same technology. In the same way DeepSeek managed to train it with such a low budget, we can even do it now faster and cheaper because we are focusing on a domain-specific thing, whereas DeepSeek was, of course, still a generalist model.
So what is the kind of initial seed that you need to start to build your own foundational model, your own AI, if you will?
Okay, so, I mean, first of all, you don't have to, right? Like, there are, like, so many agent applications. You can actually just go ahead and build it on an existing model.
Absolutely, but if you wanted the IP and you wanted to own that kind of foundation...
Well, you got to pick up the phone to NVIDIA first.
Yeah, well... You know him personally now?
Yeah, exactly. Like a, what do you call it? Speed dial.
Yeah. Hey Siri,
You need GPUs, right? Like, that's the first step. But it's not as scary as it was. Like, if I was starting this company 2 years ago, honestly, I would have to go ahead and raise $100 million just to get started. Now it's not the case. You can use companies like Predibase and Together AI, which actually offer services. They've got the GPUs. They just rent it to you. You can start with that if you have no cash. AWS offers now up to $300K free.
They do. They're quite good, AWS.
They're amazing.
Yeah,
I mean,
reach out a lot.
Startup like ecosystem owes a lot. I mean, you may... If you speak to any developer, AWS has the worst interface in the world.
It's horrible.
Frustrates the hell out of people. That's true.
But they do give you a lot of free stuff.
I mean, like a $200K for, you know, compute plus $300K for model training, they are literally writing you effectively a $500,000 check to get you started. Yeah. I don't know what startups would do without that. No. So huge thanks.
Yeah, 100%. So in terms of what lessons you've learned when building out, I guess, modeling and agents, etc., what have you learned and where is the world going? Because it's moving rapidly, right? And by the time this podcast comes out, which is only a few weeks away...
It'll have changed already.
It'll have four more models.
100%. I think there are a couple of really important learnings. The first one is control is essential. And how you take control is not with one method, right? You can't do it just with knowledge base. So most people right now, what they do is they take a closed model, they take RUG, and they put the knowledge there, off we go, right? That just doesn't work if you're in a regulated space. Because once in a while, your agent is going to say something that is completely wrong and against regulation, right? So The control is first step. How do you then control? You add multiple agents. So they check each other's homework, basically, right? Before you actually generate the utterance, we have a validation layer. We have a regulation check layer so that we make sure the control is there. Model training provides another level of control in that sense. That's the first thing. The second one is, cost is underestimated as how important it is. If you've been in enterprise relationships, it will always come down to costs. Yeah. And for example, that was quite a surprising finding for me. They would rather, some of our customers, work with a dumb chatbot that deflects users from being escalated to a human than a super smart AI agent who is super speedily transferring people to human. Why? Because your cost of support is actually going up by thanks to implementing an AI agent. Many companies you see in the market right now thinks control is escalation to a human with guardrails. It's not. No. That's a cost driver. So you have to look for the elements of control that stays within the framework of AI agents. Thirdly, though, that doesn't mean we don't need humans in the loop. We absolutely need humans in the loop. But the job for humans is changing. It's more about training the agent, checking the memory of the agent, creating more information for the agent rather than replacing or doing the job of the agent.
So where do you see agents going, and AI in particular, then? If we gave ourselves a five-year roadmap and we had to sort of say, this is where it's going, for you to scale the business and for consumers to kind of be more aware, where's it going?
5 years? I would say 90% of the jobs we do today will be done by agents. And I know this is extremely optimistic, but you know, I live now in San Francisco and I see a lot of businesses coming through, and then you can see how they are, you know, going into quite difficult functionalities in robotics. We are not only simply talking about here software side. There's also robotic side, right? Are we going to still need brain surgeons supervising operations? Yes. Mm-hmm. But I would not be surprised in 5 years' time the operation is actually being conducted by a robot who is just being supervised by a human, right? Instead of actually like having to do it. So I don't think, as coming back to my political scientist background, the heads of the governments are really digesting yet.
No.
What a big change this is. And we have to start discussing how are we going to take care of everyone who is no longer in the employment pools. And this is going to be such a major change. I think a lot of us entrepreneurs will start working on that specifically because the automation speed is incredible.
Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, that's quite exciting. We'll have to beam you in as an avatar next time because that'll be the easiest way to do it. But I mean, I've loved it. I love the business. I think it's an amazing thing. I think the world is fascinating, and I think it's something that's a hot topic, if you will, and something that will age pretty quickly because it's moving so quickly. But look, if people want to find the business, inquire, work with you, how do they do that?
If you want to work with the business, it's very easy. You can drop me a note on LinkedIn, Tuğçe Bulut, Eloquent AI, and we will get back to you.
Simple as that.
Simple as that.
So you've spoken about moving to San Francisco. We're big believers in London. We're here in London right now. But, you know, London and then Europe in general is facing some headwinds. And it seems that San Francisco is kind of the epicenter for AI right now. What are the differences in building in SF right now versus, you know, having built the last business in London?
Listen, I'm a big time Londoner myself. I bought my house here and, you know, I see myself as a lifetime Londoner. And I think there is incredible talent here. And building here from a talent pool perspective is absolutely the right place. What San Francisco gives you is the intensity that as an entrepreneur, you welcome. London is a more diverse environment. I have friends here who are artists or film directors, as well as technologists, right? In San Francisco, everyone is in AI.
Really?
There is nothing else. Yeah. You sit in a cafe, the guy sitting next to you ordering his coffee is building a super interesting AI company. You get talking and, you know, it has a cluster effect, basically. So for me personally, I love being there right now because I love the intensity of discussions around AI. And every day I feel I meet new people and it gives me new ideas. But it's not for everyone, right? You may not want that intensity in your life. And we are still hiring here as well. It's not like we are not. Eloquent AI will have a London office in addition to our San Francisco office. And we are continuing to hire people in Europe, not only just even London. We have engineers, you know, in Portugal, in Romania, etc. I don't see any reason why we would not do that.
Amazing.
So it's been a fantastic discussion here today. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You know, obviously, we'd love to follow the journey over the next few years. You've just received some very exciting news in terms of investment, which unfortunately we can't share today, but well done on that.
Thank you so much. Not quite yet. Give me a few weeks to announce.
Well, as soon as it's out there, we'll be sharing it. So obviously, follow the journey. And yeah, it's going to be a very exciting few years, I think.
My pleasure. It was so much fun to talk to you guys.
Thanks, T. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's a wrap for this episode of Success is in the Mind with me, Oliver Bruce, and Hugo Tilmouth. We hope you enjoyed today's conversations and have taken away some valuable insights to fuel your own journey. If you liked what you heard, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs a little bit of inspiration. You can also follow us on social media for the behind-the-scenes content. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, keep pushing forward, stay curious, and remember, success is always in the mind.